Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the most recent five, including this one, will be on there soon, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And all the shows, including the last five, are archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Okay, now let's get started. This time we're going to talk about keeping an open mind. And I think perhaps the question has been presented that are we really listening in relationship to having an open mind? Are we really listening to what the other people, the other participants, and even the people on our own side, so to speak, are saying? And are we willing to do something about it, to really think? So I think perhaps our first question is, and I know it's been pointed out, and it's really true, that this is a global show and that the expression open mind is rather an English-speaking idiom. It's an Americanism, so to speak. But so I'm going to say perhaps a definition of open mind, which is that the willingness to listen and consider other viewpoints and opinions. I think that's kind of what an open mind does. So we're going to start with my definition, and then we're going to talk about everybody else, too. And I see that we have lots of participation already. Thank you very much. I see we have lots of people that have come before and some new people, too. And so the question is, what is an open mind, and how do we do this? How do we really keep an open mind when trying to reach consensus? When doing even a workshop or a seminar or with anything that has participation, but especially when we need to go forward to reach consensus and to reach a conclusion, to reach a solution. So we're going to need to have, well, we're going to need to listen to each other, aren't we? And, you know, here's an interesting point. Lainey says that an open mind is being able to accept and change your position or opinion even if you've already publicly announced it. What a good thought. And other people are agreeing with that. Not only being willing to change your position, but even after you've already kind of taken the stand and you've already shown that this is your position, you've already publicly announced it, perhaps even to some followers, or perhaps to the internet or to the media in some way. Being willing to change, being able to accept and change position or opinion, even if you have already publicly announced it. That's a very good point about people have to truly have an open mind, because no one likes to say that perhaps they were mistaken before. You see, and people generally don't like to do that. And therefore, they could perhaps think about their change in position or opinion as a natural progression from whatever was publicly announced. You see, it's a little bit of marketing in that, I'm afraid. But, you know, it's human nature not to want to show that you would change. But sometimes, if you have an open mind, you kind of have to. Very good point about the public announcement. And Patricia and others are saying that an open mind is one that encourages discussion between all sides. Yes, that is how, of course, we have participation. And what makes us really a good host and what makes us good participants and that we encourage everyone to voice their opinion. And also, of course, there is some preliminary communication between the parties, too, usually by phone, by email, by whatever. And I always think it's important to include everyone when we have an email communication going, so that no one's excluded and surprised when they get together. You know, there is reply all, and I know that one needs to be careful doing that, but everyone needs to be kept in the picture, in the loop. Everyone needs to be encouraged to have discussion between all sides. Mm-hmm. You know, this point is being made quite a bit, too. Thank you for all of your participation. Arthur is making a very good point. He says that an open mind is acknowledging the difference between fact and opinion. Acknowledging the difference between fact and opinion. Because isn't it true that our opinions, you know, Zeng is saying this, and I was just about to say, and then Zeng said it even better than I was going to. He says that you use facts to form an opinion and conclusion. That's a very good point, that there's a big difference between a fact and an opinion, and that sometimes they're easily mixed up because opinions are sometimes stated as though they were facts. So you have to think about that. And sometimes we think our opinions are kind of facts because we're fairly certain of their validity, of their truth. Those of us with an open mind are willing to challenge that, are willing to say, well, not too sure. Is that really absolutely true? Is it a fact? Or is it my opinion and my conclusion based on a fact? Interesting point about the difference between fact and opinion. Thank you very much. And, you know, this is now that we're talking about the difference between fact and opinion, Christian and others are making an interesting point that he says that you need an open mind when researching facts to make certain that they are actually facts and not the opinion of the expert being relied upon. You need an open mind when researching facts to make certain that they are actually facts and not the opinion of the expert being relied upon. Very good point. You know, and others are saying using the word research bias, Felix and others, and that's absolutely true, that you always need to think about the source of your facts, right? And sometimes, even if it's not something, we see sometimes in the media that scientists and other researchers have somehow doctored the facts, have been somewhat fraudulent in their activities in order to create an outcome so they can get funding or whatever. And that is actually being unscientific and unethical. But, you know, you have to think about the research bias of your expert and whether or not it's a straight fact or one that has been peppered with opinion, that's been slanted. Not in a bad way necessarily, but research bias happens, and you need to be aware of it. You need to be aware of the background and what the source is of the research. A very good point. Mm-hmm. And Bruce says the source is important to determine the facts because you can validate anything using the internet. It's a question of which authority and their credentials. Good point. That just researching it on the internet, yeah, it's good. Yeah, you know, Bruce and others are agreeing, other people are agreeing, that you can validate anything using the internet. It's a question of which authority, and authority has been put in quotation marks, and their credentials. Which authority and their credentials? You know, and I have nothing against it because I think it's a lovely starting point and really quite an adventure in use of the internet. But sometimes, well, I teach also, I teach an MBA class in international law and economics. And sometimes my students would really like to use Wikipedia as a source, as a research source, as a authority. And it's kind of like, well, Wikipedia, I suppose, is not that good an example. People are saying that Wikipedia is really reliable. Basically, it is. But a lot of the internet is kind of community gathered and not really easily sourced, not really easy to find out what the source is. So you have to think about what the bias is that I'm looking at and why, and not just take the word of somebody that this is a fact. Look it up independently and see if what you're dealing with really is, or it's kind of, well, yeah, people are using the term half-truth, that it is not exactly a lie and not exactly wrong, but it doesn't exactly tell all the details and the whole story either. See, that's the thing about facts. Facts you got to think about because we're going to form our opinions and conclusions on them. You need an open mind about the research, too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Sydney and others are saying, that everyone starts with assumptions about the truth and the facts that support it. An open mind might have to examine the source of those assumption facts. We start out with assumptions. Well, they're kind of, yeah, and other people are calling them opinions. But we start out, well, we start out knowing something, right? We start out, we've looked at what we consider to be an unbiased fact, and we formed a conclusion, an opinion. And as we've said before, we might even kind of have publicly stated what we think. But if we truly have an open mind, we are open to a different interpretation of the information, a different idea about the facts. Doesn't mean we were wrong. It just means that somebody else is right, too. And therefore, that's where the consensus comes in. That's where the compromise comes in. That's where the art of our craft of mediation and alternative dispute resolution comes into play. Because we all have assumptions. You know, people, this is kind of, I know it's a global show, and I suppose this is somewhat of an American saying, but you know, there's an old saying that I know how the world works. How the world works. You know, how it says how the world works takes as a fact, it creates facts that are due to childhood cultural training. And I see quite a few people are saying things like, well, you have some base assumptions about how the world works due to your childhood cultural training, due to where you were born and what culture you were born into, and maybe a religion or whatever. And yeah, those are assumptions about the way things are, aren't they? Are they facts? And people are saying no. Basically speaking, that kind of an assumption is not really a fact. It's an opinion handed down, isn't it? It's an outside idea that we have assimilated, that we've taken in as our own. And it may not be wrong. You know, people are saying, what's wrong with that? Well, there's nothing wrong with it. We all have base life experience or training type assumptions. Nothing wrong with that, but we need to recognize them so that we can have an open mind for consensus and negotiation and for plain ordinary dealing with other people that don't come from our same background. Mm-hmm. And they have their own kind of long-held childhood-formed beliefs. They're going to have to come to the table and reach consensus and a wee bit of compromise, too. Mm-hmm. Now, quite a few people say, I suppose it's true. Daniel and others are saying that often these kind of assumptions, the cultural and societal and maybe even religious, we're going to call it that cultural, these cultural type base how the world work assumptions are often that your group or the group of the person being thought about, the your own group and everybody thinks their own group is inherently superior, and that that must be acknowledged. Every group thinks they are inherently superior, and that the other participants should understand that, should acknowledge it, and that that's what needs to be overcome to have an open mind. This feeling that you know it all and you're inherently better than the other people, and therefore they should follow you because your opinions and conclusions are true and right. Inherently superior. I wouldn't particularly see, these are wonderful shows because we all think about things that we wouldn't necessarily have thought about. I don't know that I would exactly have thought about it that way. But I have to admit that I'm getting a lot of agreement that that's a real good point, that most groups are pretty much certain, according to their cultural tradition, etc., that they are rather superior, at least in knowledge, to the other groups. Interesting point that needs to be watched out for, that we need to think about when we're dealing with other people. With the kinds of people. And now that we've talked about the inherent superiority concept, that we're kind of righter. I don't know if we're better looking, but we're kind of more right is the inherently superior. And I have to admit that I don't know that that's not a interesting thought and something that often happens and needs to be watched out for. You know, Tucker's saying, and others are saying, that education created bias due to lack of in-depth training happens too. I guess that's towards the inherently superior, huh? That you are inherently superior not because you are part of a particular cultural group, but you are part of an level of education type group, or even maybe people are saying even came from the same fraternity or sorority or something. There's some sort of a group affiliation that makes you feel smarter, that makes you feel more superior. And you need an open mind to realize that, to go, well, you know, I'm really not smarter or more superior in learning. It's just that I have a certificate extra, or that it's just kind of, we have to think about it. You know, it's not necessarily inherently true. Lack of education or more education. Yeah, this is funny. Sharon says that sitting through a class doesn't make you an expert. Oh, that's so true. Sitting through a class doesn't make you an expert. And I got news for you. Having an advanced degree doesn't make you smart either, because I don't know if I'm smart, but I know quite a few people with advanced degrees that, well, let's just say they don't necessarily have an open mind. How's that? And it is a good point about the superiority concept, because, boy, they sure think they are. And, you know, I've got a couple of extra degrees, and I'm not too sure about that. I'm pretty much certain it's not true, because a lot of times your expert is not necessarily someone who has a piece of paper showing they sat through school. It might be someone who has an actual hands-on experience. They're an expert and probably more valuable because they will have a more pragmatic, workable solution to get us around and into consensus. Yes, Carol and others are saying that you need to be cautious of the source of expert facts. They're often opinions and conclusions stated as fact. Got to look at that. Got to see if that's really, if that's based on a truth or at least a research, or it's really somebody's opinion. And Stephen says, the more the educational degrees, the less open the mind to a new direction. And Andrea says it's because they all become know-it-alls. That's probably also a kind of an Americanism, and this is a global show. But you know what a know-it-all is. That usually the word insufferable comes before that. Kind of know-it-alls about everything and unwilling to change. The less they open the mind to a new direction. So, now I suppose, and this question has actually been posed, that we're going to now consider whether, now that we've decided what an open mind is, right? We're going to see if you're going to need one to have compromise and to reach consensus on how to proceed. Is that a necessity? Do you have to have an open mind? And pretty much everybody is saying yes, because if you don't have an open mind, you'll be unwilling to listen to the other participants. You know, it's not, if you have an open mind, you don't have to change. That's not a requirement. The requirement is that you be willing to listen to rational argument, right? That you be willing to consider changing your position or modifying it or creating a subcategory of some sort, that you're willing to modify, that you're willing to change, you see? And it's not, you know, necessary that you actually, you might be right. And the other participants who also have an open mind might come over to see that your argument is the most rational. Works both ways. You see, we're not always the only ones reaching negotiation, reaching a compromise. No. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Nick and others are saying it's because compromise really is changing position, and that only happens after rational argument. Yeah, you see, you can't have compromise without an open mind, because you've got to kind of change your position when you compromise, right? You have to say, well, I'll back off just a little bit if the other side, he or she, will back off just a little bit and come a little towards me, and I'll come a little towards them, and pretty soon we'll have some consensus going. But, yeah, compromise is kind of change, isn't it, so that you can reach consensus. And others are saying that only if the rational argument is based on unbiased facts so that you can draw conclusions and opinions as to what should be done. Thank you, Jan and others. Only if the rational argument to cause you to change position or opinion is based on unbiased facts so you can draw conclusions and opinions as to what should be done. Now, that's the ultimate, isn't it? Conclusions and opinions as to what should be done. What do we need to do, and how are we going to get there? And one of the things we need to do is keep an open mind. And quite a few people using the word creative, Dimitri and others. And, yes, thank you for all of your participation. It is an open mind is indeed, I think, maybe a more creative mind, because you see you're trying to find solutions kind of outside of the traditional often. And that's very creative. You know, we say think outside the box, and that's a fairly common term. And it really means that instead of sitting in your little box that's all nice and safe and has the four walls and you're very used to, you could need to be creative and have an open mind so that you can, well, change the shape of your box. You know what I mean? So that you can go forward and really think of something and go, yeah, you know what? I think that's going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very good point that Maria is making. Having an open mind does not require the abandoning of your moral compass. You just need to be certain that the guide is a compass, not a rigid stick. Oh, I like it. A little compass analogy. Fantastic. Thank you. Wonderful. Having an open mind does not require abandoning your moral compass, your moral assumptions, right? You just need to be certain that the guide is a compass, not a rigid stick. Good point. That a compass moves, right? And it doesn't always go in one direction. And it's been my experience, and maybe I don't have a very fancy compass because I don't do much camping, but that as you progress, Even if you're walking in a straight line, you think you're walking in a straight line, compasses jiggle. They move. They're not stationary. And you know, that's a very good point, that you don't have to abandon your values, for God's sake. It's just that you need to think about other people's moral compass and whether or not you're really on the same page there, that you really are very, very similar and you're really working towards the same goal. And it's not two paths that have diverged need to come together, because you're really working towards the same goal and you're closer than you think. And that's often the case. And Jason says you need to be willing to encourage and use ideas from all participants in order to reach agreement and go forward. And that's the idea. You know, Emma and others are actually kind of disagreeing, because they say that we're being too literal, and that oftentimes there are ambiguities and you need to be open to new solutions. That it's not so much that you need to change your position or change your mind or change in order to have an open mind to change, but it might be to create new, to go in a new direction, or at least have a backup solution, or to have a solution that has more than one component to it, or more than several. But that you need to, often there are ambiguities that need to be open, and you need to be open to new solutions. Thank you, Emma. It's a real good point, that you need to really be willing to work through the ambiguities, work through what's ever going to. And you know, this is a very good point too. Oftentimes it seems like we're speaking that we're going to have one meeting and we're going to solve it, a series of meetings, and we're going to solve the issue, right? We're going to reach consensus and agreement and we're going to go forward. And then that's going to be that. We're going to have done it. We're going to have solved it. We're going to be done. And we could be friends or whatever, but we're not going to have to actually go into consensus building again. But the answer is, and William Mick says this very clearly, that sometimes you are forced to use current information and facts. You can't do better than that. You can't do better than the facts that are known now, the current facts. But facts change over time, so you need to visit the issues again to make certain that you are still on the right path. Facts change over time. That's kind of a true statement, isn't it? Thank you, William. Facts change over time, and your consensus, your agreement, your formed opinion with everybody else as to what to do might need to be altered and looked at, so that we all know that we're still reaching whatever our goal was, need to be altered to accommodate kind of a new reality, right? That you need to know what the current facts are 6 months from now, if it's something that moves fairly quickly. And that you might need to make other meetings. You might have to come together again. You might have to have regular schedules. And at each one of them, what are we going to do? Yes, thank you, people are actually answering. Thank you for your participation. You're going to need to keep an open mind again as to what the solution will be. An interesting thought. And, you know, and this is, of course, a neat little segue. People are going, yes, are you going to talk about recipes? Yes, I am. And that's why we create the convivial atmosphere, too, with the food and with the coming together physically in a room, so that we can look at each other and discuss what needs to be done, which is oftentimes very effective. But a lot of times you need kind of a regularly scheduled meeting. And it doesn't have to be weekly or monthly or something, but sometimes if it is a fairly complex issue, or there's more than one, you'll need to revisit what it is we're going to do about it, what it is that we need to do for conclusion, to get done what needs to be done. And that's a very good point. Thank you. So, now, we're going to talk a wee bit about the convivial atmosphere that we're going to make because people are going to be coming more than once. Now that's an interesting thought. We're going to have people want to come back. And that's really the point of the food. It's not to feed people dinner because they are hungry. It's the creation of a convivial atmosphere so that when we need a timeout, we need a moment to try to gather our thoughts and to go, well, my initial reaction was no, but I could compromise a little bit. How about this far? If the other side will compromise a little bit, how about this far? And pretty soon you're back at the table because you've never left the area because we had a nice break with food and everybody likes to have a snack or even lunch or whatever. That gave everyone time to cool down and then reconvene without losing them. That's really the point of the food too, because we may need also to meet more than once. See? That's a good idea. Okay. Now, those of you who've been here, yeah, people are going, you're going to say this. Yes, I am. Those of you who've been here before know that I say this for every show. And I mentioned that the shows are all archived on the radio station website, which is blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. And the five latest shows, the five newest ones, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. So, and yes, I am going to say what I always say. This is so true, because I always say that you need to label what you bring. Very important. And before we get to the labeling part, we are going to have some communication between the parties, right? And the host will email, phone, whatever it is that you need to do, and ask about religious prohibitions for food, allergies, and dietary restrictions. And that will be communicated to everyone. And then everyone will come with their dish labeled, even if they bought it, labeled. Not what the title of it is, but what actually is in it, so that we don't get a nasty surprise. We don't want anybody to get sick or excited or offended. It's a good time out, a convivial time out, and it's important that it stay that way and nobody has a bad time and gets sick. So, very, very important, labeling, to actually say what is in the dish so you can decide if you can eat it. And now we also, those of you who have been here before, thank you for coming back. Welcome to the new people. Also, it is, in my opinion at least, the host's responsibility to have some extra food just in case. I hate to run out is what it really is. I've got kind of an idea that one should never throw a party, so to speak, and then run out of food. So we're going to label it, and also we're going to have a safe recipe that the host is going to provide also in addition to whatever he or she was bringing, because then pretty much everyone can eat it. What makes a recipe safe? I think it is not too many ingredients, ingredients that are well known so that nobody goes, what is that? I don't know if I can eat it or not. Ingredients that are well known and not too many of them, and also ingredients that are not prone to allergies and religious or dietary restrictions. So this is tonight's safe recipe. It is cashew noodles. And of course, if you don't like noodles, you can use rice. You do whatever you want. These are all The recipes are suggestions. They are not written in stone. They are not necessarily to be followed exactly, although measurements and stuff is pretty much true. And if you're going to use different kinds of proteins, I always say make sure they're cooked completely through. So I like to use egg noodles on this. They are like fettuccine noodles, thicker and flatter than spaghetti, but not the tubed type of pasta that we often use, the long strips. So we're going to have a pound of those thin egg noodles. We're going to cook them al dente, and we're going to drain them, set them aside. We're going to have about a quarter of a cup of vegetable oil, a cup and a half, about half a cup of roasted cashew nuts, those lovely nuts. You do not need to use whole ones because they're very expensive where I am. You can use pieces. It'll give the same taste. Whole is, of course, more beautiful. And be sure and label this because some people are allergic to nuts. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have about half a cup of roasted cashew nuts. I like to use the pieces. It's just, it tastes just as good, and it's a little less expensive. A big red pepper that we're going to, of course, core and seed and thinly slice. Four stalks of celery we're going to also cut into little, well, cubes is a funny word for celery, but kind of thick slices on the diagonal. So they look nice in the bowl is what it really is. And I like 3 tablespoons of chopped scallions, those little green. That's about half a bunch, maybe. And in this is kind of a funny thing to put in here because it's a very American thing, but it looks so great in the dish. And it's really quite tasty and popular. I like to use a big drained can. What's that, about 12 ounces of those little whole baby corns. In the States, they're quite common to get. If you can't get them, actual sweet corn, frozen corn, the kernels will go nicely too because they are actually pre-cooked. You could eat them raw if you wanted to, although we're not going to. But it's, you know, any kind, like, I think corn not only looks nice, but it gives it a sweet flavor. I like those little baby corns that come in the can. And also we're going to have lovely green sprouts, about 4 ounces. I like to trim the little tails off of them. I know they're edible, but they just don't look nice. I think they look prettier. And a couple tablespoons of soy sauce. So we've already got our pasta cooked, right? We're going to heat the oil in a big frying pan. A wok is nice if you have it. If you're going to make this with the group, with the participants, and it is certainly doable, because it's easily prepped and easily made, and it smells nice. A wok is very cool. But if you don't have one, a big frying pan will do it. And we're going to actually, I like to warm the cashew nuts and get the oil kind of going on them. So I put the oil, the cashew nuts in first for about a minute until they get all nice and golden and kind of stir them around. Then we're going to add the pepper, the celery, the scallions, the corn, and the sprouts to the pan. And we're going to stir fry for just about 3 minutes because it doesn't take very long. Then we're going to stir in the noodles and the soy sauce. And we're going to toss the whole thing and combine it and leave it on the heat and keep tossing it so it doesn't stick to the bottom and get it all nice and combined and hot. And then we're going to serve it. And it's going to be just yummy. Yes, you can add protein to this if you'd like. The caveat I always say is, of course, you need to cook it through. I sometimes add chicken. But this is a lovely vegetarian dish. It's partially why it's the safe dish. Got nuts. Got to tell everybody what kind of nuts they are and that they exist in there. But it's the kind of a potluck, the kind of a recipe that is easily doable if you have kitchen facilities with the group. And participating in cooking something is a lovely, convivial, and dare I say, bonding experience. So, yes, it works out extremely well. and this is easy to do because it doesn't have a lot of prep, and it takes practically no time because it's stir-fried. And, of course, you do the noodles first so people don't have to stand around waiting for the pot to boil. But, yeah, it's a lovely, lovely, safe recipe, except for the nuts part. And, you know, if people are allergic to one kind of, somebody's allergic to one kind of nuts but not others, you could substitute something different. Although, well, if I'm very certain that there's no one with an allergy, really certain of it, and I label it very clearly, I must confess that I often use peanuts in this recipe just because they are more readily available and, quite frankly, they're a lot less expensive if you're going to make a really big batch because you've got a lot of people coming. So that is our safe recipe. Safe or not, we're going to label it. And now let's get to our adventure recipe. Why is this an adventure recipe? A little more number of ingredients. A little more likely to have some dietary prohibitions. A lot of religions don't eat pork. And a lot of items that it's not very easy to see. They are hidden, as almost as condiments, and therefore they must be labeled because you never know what someone is going to have a bad reaction to. And we don't, what's supposed to be convivial, we don't want that. So, we're going to serve a whole bunch of rice under this. So I like, you all know, well, those of you who've been here before, all know that the rice I like to have to the side so people can pick whatever they'd like. So we're going to have stir-fried pork. We've got 3 tablespoons of sesame oil. It gives a lovely taste. If it's hard to find or you think people might be allergic to it or something, you can just use regular oil. 2 pounds of pork that we're going to cut into fine strips, little thin strips. Whatever kind of pork that will do it. That pork fillets, not pork chops because they're too expensive, like pork fillet, the pork roast type thing. 2 onions that we're going to actually cut in half and slice because it looks pretty on the plate. 3 garlic cloves that we're also going to slice really for the same reason. I know people say I put a lot of garlic in things, so put less if you don't like it. I like to have mushrooms in it just because they give taste and they look nice. That needs to be labeled, of course, carefully because mushrooms are oftentimes something that people don't eat. And if that's true, just leave them out. About 1/2 pound of mushrooms that we're also going to slice. About 1/2 pound also of green beans that we're going to cut into segments. Sliced but kind of wide. Like cut each bean into 3. Crosswise, not lengthwise. Crosswise, yes, crosswise. 2 oranges. That we're going to peel and cut into segments because it looks beautiful and it tastes yummy. 3 tablespoons of honey, which is one of those things that doesn't show, but you got to label it. 3 tablespoons of honey. I add 3 tablespoons of cooking sherry just because it gives a complexity of taste and flavor. A lot of people object to using any kind of alcohol, religions and other objections, any kind of alcohol in cooking. So if you've got people that don't like it, don't do it. Just put in a little more honey. Or, you know, even you might have a little bit of soy sauce if you're not going to use the sherry. People are saying to use a little bit of orange juice in this instead of the sherry. Seems good, yeah. You don't want to make it too wet, so you can decide when you're doing it what you think. So we're going to heat the oil. Also, if we're going to do this with other people or just because we own one, a wok is nice, but a big frying pan will do. Personally, I use a big frying pan. And the first thing we're going to do, of course, is we're going to cook the pork because we don't like to have any kind of raw protein in our food. And so we're going to take the little slices of pork and we're going to stir-fry them for a couple of minutes each until they're really cooked and kind of crispy. It'll take you a couple of batches in order to do that because if you put too much in the pot at once, you're going to have unevenness and it'll never get properly done. So, and then you then you take the batches out and you stick them on the top. We're going to add the onion. Now, this is the oil. We've cooked the pork and we're taking it out. So we're going to add the onion to the oil, the onion, the garlic, the mushrooms, and the green beans. Stir fry that whole thing for, what, about 5 minutes, so they're all cooked through and hot. Now, we've got all of the little ingredients in there. We're going to add the pork back in. Now we're going to add the orange segments because we didn't put them in originally because we want them to remain basically whole for taste and for visuals and because they really don't need to be cooked so much. So we're going to add the orange segments, the honey, and the sherry, and we're going to stir it around for a couple of minutes just to make everything incorporated and hot. We're done. We're going to take the rice and put it separate. If you like pasta under it, go for it. And we have a lovely stir-fried pork. Delicious. Very, very popular. Very kind of on the sweet side. And the sweet goes nice with the garlic. And it's really quite delightful. And very popular, actually. People object to the sherry. Don't use the sherry. We've basically had two stir-fried dishes because if you have the facilities, they're wonderful group activities. And someone actually gave me this recipe with the pork and brought it, and I went, wow, that's really yummy, and it was very, very popular. So there you've got it. We've had an adventure recipe. Why is it an adventure recipe? Yeah, because it's got the pork. Good point. And it's got several ingredients like the honey and the sherry that don't show but could be a problem to someone. And therefore, it must be very, very carefully labeled and talked about ahead of time, too. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a very good point that people are bringing up because we did two stir-fry things. And I have made an assumption, and this is absolutely true, that people have stir-fried things before. But when you stir-fry something, you know that the pan, the frying pan, the wok, whatever you've got, has to be extremely hot because the oil should be really, really hot before you add the first ingredients or it won't crisp up. It won't cook properly. So you can't just kind of put it into a warmish pot, the oil in there. It has to be, the oil and the pot have to be extremely hot, and then you add the first ingredients because you're going to cook it fast and stir it around. Stir fry, yeah. So it needs to be extremely hot. That's a very good point to make, and that's true of all. Thank you. Thank you, Evelyn and others, that I didn't make the point that it needs to be extremely hot. And also, people are saying that as long as I've said that basic thing, the other thing about stir-frying is that the ingredients, whatever you've got, should be about the same size. When you cut into pieces, they should be about the same size so they cook evenly. And also it looks better, but really so that they cook evenly. Because as you can see, we're cooking fast. Stir frying is like that, and it needs to all be heated through, and the pork especially, of course, needs to be cooked through separately ahead of time in the hot oil and stir fried first, and then you add the other ingredients, and then you re-add the pork, just like all stir fried, really. And yes, I have used pork, but of course people ask me about rabbit and things. Those are rabbit and other meats like that would be very expensive where I am. I'm in the United States. If it's something that you can readily get, go for it. The idea is to cook it quickly and thoroughly. Oftentimes I use chicken. It's really because chicken is also easy to come by and relatively inexpensive. So, yeah, you could substitute chicken with this. And it might even, it's a good point. You could make it a safer recipe if you put chicken in it. Very good point you've made. Thank you very much for your participation. And we have reached the end of our time together. Well, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for coming. I always learn something, and I hope that you learn something, too, from these discussions. please come again. If you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. And the last five shows, the most recent, this one's going to be there pretty soon. In fact, the miracle of computerdom, it's going to be there quite fast, actually. The last five are archived on the website, The last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. The rest of them, including the last five, all of them, are archived at the radio station as blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope you come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.